Greetings, listeners. Radio Derb on the air here. That was one of Franz Joseph Haydn's Derbyshire Marches, and this is your peripatetically genial host, John Derbyshire, with news from here, there, and everywhere. This week we span the world, from Greece to Turkmenistan, from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, from Turkey to Yorkshire. Yes, a varied menu of the sad, the strange, the wonderful, and the deplorable. Here we go. Remember that 60s movie, Bonnie and Clyde? Remember that? Sex and death in Depression-era Texas? Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway finally working out the connection between hose and stanchion just before the mean old sheriff ambushes them? The hardest part of the movie to watch is after Gene Hackman gets shot in the head as the gang is escaping. Poor old Gene takes a long time to die, thrashing and howling and bleeding everywhere, while his wife's wailing and nobody can think of anything to do. Obama's precious healthcare bill is pretty much in that condition right now. I should say bills. There are actually three healthcare bills in play. The House bill, the Senate bill, and a spiffy new bill unveiled by the president himself this week. The president's bill includes a wonderful new idea to meet the objection, so often raised in respect of the other two plans, that health insurance premiums will go through the roof. What is this wonderful new idea? Price controls! Yes, your health insurer won't raise your premiums because the federal government will make it illegal for them to do so. If the health insurers complain that they can't make a profit and will go into bankruptcy, well, the president will just make that illegal too. And if it looks as though people are just going to dump their healthcare stocks on the market, well, hey, we'll have another law to stop them doing that. My question here is, why not just cut to the chase and make illness illegal? Problem solved. The paradox in the healthcare debate is that the public at large wants some reform. Listener, I want some reform. We're all fed up with shelling out more and more for less and less every year. We're fed up with watching our family doctor's office disappear under great drifts of paperwork. We're fed up with trying to figure out why insurers in our state have to cover acupuncture, moxibustion, aromatherapy, homeopathy and voodoo, while the insurers in the next state don't. Yet we can't just buy our insurance from that cheaper state. We're fed up with so much of what we pay ending up in the pockets of smarmy, sleazy trial lawyers like John Edwards and their whinging, lying, malingering clients. We're fed up with standing in line in the emergency room behind platoons of illegal immigrants. We're fed up with the whole ramshackle healthcare system. We just don't understand why it seems to be not possible to fix any of it for less than $1 trillion. With people wanting something done, the prognosis is that something or other will be done. It won't be comprehensive healthcare reform, though, and it won't cost $1 trillion. The grandiose schemes being put forward in the House, Senate, and presidential bills will mostly end up on the cutting room floor, delivering us just a few minor tweaks here and there. Comprehensive healthcare reform is in the same shape Gene Hackman was in, twitching and moaning in its drawn-out death throes, shot in the head by presidential arrogance, congressional overreach, and fiscal collapse. Or, as C.W. Moss put it in Bonnie and Clyde, dirt in the fuel line just blowed it away. Speaking of whinging plaintiffs, I'm going to join the half-dozen commentators who have already nominated Rhonda Smith of Tennessee for an Academy Award. Retired social worker Rhonda testified to a House committee looking at allegations that Toyota automobiles come without brakes or an ignition switch. Her Lexus just ran away with her, snivelled Mrs. Smith, dabbing at her tears with a sheaf of trial lawyer business cards. It shot up to 100 miles an hour, and she could do nothing but pray for help. At last the Almighty heard her voice, took a break from putting out a kitchen grease fire in the Virgo supercluster, and braked the car for her. It took a long time for Toyota to respond to her complaints, whimpered Miss Smith, and even then they were dismissive. So am I, lady. I was weeping too by this point, but I was weeping for my country. A retired social worker testifying to a room full of Congress critters. Or, to put it another way, one person who has never in her life created a dime of wealth addressing a room full of the same, with the common goal of showing those disgusting, heartless capitalists who's the real boss in today's USA. Mr. Gradgrind duly showed up in the person of Akio Toyoda, the president of Toyota Motors. Rather to my surprise, Mr. Toyoda was not wearing a tailcoat, top hat, and monocle, nor was he carrying in each hand a big bag with a dollar sign prominently marked on it. In fact, by contrast with the reserved and gentlemanly Mr. Toyoda, the blubbering Ms. Smith and the howling mob of parasites constituting the House committee made a sorry spectacle. Maintaining his proper and manly restraint, Mr. Toyoda did not lose his temper, as he had every right to. He did not remind the room full of tax-eaters that his company has invested billions in America, building great factories, employing 250,000 workers, founding countless charitable enterprises, including one close to my heart, one to promote math and science education in our public schools, to give our students some relief from the lessons in diversity awareness and AIDS prevention that block out most of their schedules. Mr. Toyoda displayed heroic self-control in the face of sanctimonious hectoring and racial insults from the massed legions of pain-feelers and trial-bar shills in front of him. If that had been me up there, I would have projectile vomited on Carolyn Maloney when she asked me what I had learned from my session in the baboon house. I decided then and there that my next car will be a Toyota. Akio Toyoda is this week's Radio Derb hero for his performance in front of the House committee. And all the time he was up there testifying, you could see the thoughts scrolling across his retinas. We lost a war to these clowns? A quote from the Wall Street Journal, quote, nationwide strike paralyzes Greece. Tens of thousands of Greeks took to the streets Wednesday as much of the country went on a 24-hour strike against government austerity measures, end quote. What's happening over there is the government has been running up huge deficits. 13% of GDP last year. 13%. And the European Union has a limit of 3%. So they're leaning on Greece to get her deficit down. To do that, the government has frozen public sector hiring, cut public sector benefits, and raised taxes. Greeks are taking to the streets. On Wednesday in Athens, police broke up a mob with tear gas. Could this happen here? Well, let's see. The US deficit was 10% of GDP last year. It will be 11% this year. It's been over the EU limit of 3% in 5 of the last 10 years. In a nutshell, if the USA were a member of the EU, we'd be Greece, pretty much. If the Greek government has been mismanaging the economy, what has our federal government been doing to our economy? And the Greeks at least have the EU to act as a daddy, imposing some discipline on them. Who do we have? Oh, excuse me. Hello? No. How many times do I have to tell you? I don't want to buy any US Treasury bonds. No, not even at 5 cents on the dollar. Goodbye. That pesky Chinese guy again. Who gave him my office number? Where was I? Oh, yes, Greece and her fiscal problems. And not just Greece. Spain is a few steps behind on the same road. And then Portugal, Italy, Ireland. It's a spreading problem. Name a state with democratic government, an overmanned public sector, a private sector shackled and chained with regulations, taxes and litigation, and an underclass with no marketable skills, and I'll show you trouble with a capital T. Let's be constructive, though. What can we do to avert the kind of fiscal crack-up Greece is having? What can we do? Oh, I know. Let's launch a vast new entitlement program. Then let's raise taxes and expand the deficit to pay for it. Is that a great idea or what? Here is this week's story on the delights of multiculturalism. I don't know if the name Raoul Wallenberg is much remembered nowadays. Wallenberg was a Swedish businessman working in Hungary during the early 1940s. When the Nazis and their puppet Hungarian government started deporting Jews to the extermination camps en masse, Wallenberg got himself attached to Sweden's Budapest embassy as a diplomat and handed out Swedish identity documents to as many Jews as he could reach, saving tens of thousands from the camps. When Soviet troops entered Budapest in 1945, Wallenberg was hustled off and shot, on account of Stalin not holding humanitarians in very high regard. Nor Jews either, come to think of it. Wallenberg's story was one episode in the modern history of Jews in Sweden, which reflects well on that country. After the Nazis occupied Norway and Denmark, for example, Sweden opened itself to Jewish refugees from the Gestapo in those countries. Well, that was then, and this is now. London Daily Telegraph, February 20th, headline: Jews leave Swedish city after sharp rise in anti-Semitic hate crimes. Story, quote: When she first arrived in Sweden after her rescue from a Nazi concentration camp, Judith Popinski was treated with great kindness. She raised a family in the city of Malmö, and for the next 6 decades lived happily in her adopted homeland, until last year. In 2009, a chapel serving the city's 700-strong Jewish community was set ablaze. Jewish cemeteries were repeatedly desecrated. Worshippers were abused on their way home from prayer, and Hitler was mockingly chanted in the streets by masked men. I never thought I would see this hatred again in my lifetime, not in Sweden anyway, Mrs. Popinski told us. End quote. Now that's pretty shocking. Who are the perps here? Neo-Nazis? Or what the liberal media likes to call extreme right-wingers? Not exactly. This Jew-baiting is being done mostly by elements from the 20% of Malmö's population who are Muslims. They are aided and abetted by left-wing radicals, of which Sweden has a good supply. The left-wing mayor of Malmö, for example, a fellow named Ilmar Reepalu, is on record with the opinion that what the Malmö Jews see as naked anti-Semitism is in fact just an understandable reaction to Israeli policy in the Middle East. The mayor also told the Daily Telegraph that, quote, if Jews from the city want to move to Israel, that is not a matter for Malmö. Well, plenty of them are doing just that. One of them, a lawyer named Marcus Eilenberg, told the Telegraph that he and his wife had considered moving to Stockholm, where Jews feel safer than in Malmö, but, quote, we decided not to, because in 5 years' time I think it will be just as bad there, end quote. Stockholm. Oh, that's where you will find a handsome memorial to Raoul Wallenberg, soon to be removed to make way for a statue of Osama bin Laden. Hey, every age has its heroes. Okay, pop quiz. What is the United States military for? If you answered, to defend our nation against her enemies, you can go report for latrine detail. For the correct answer, I refer you to the statement by General George W. Casey, Jr., talking with George Stephanopoulos on November 8th last, following the Fort Hood shooting. Quote, "What happened at Fort Hood was a tragedy, but I believe it would be an even greater tragedy if our diversity becomes a casualty here." Yes, folks, that's the mission of the U.S. military, to celebrate diversity. If 14 of our troops are massacred by an affirmative action hire Islamist gone berserk, that's a tragedy. But if there's any slackening of the Army's commitment to diversity, that's a greater tragedy, according to General Casey. Well, all right, I know, this is old news. But here's an update from my own web browsing this week. I wanted to say something more about this lunatic business of putting women on submarines, so I went to the Navy website to see what they had to say. It's not hard to find. It's www.navy.mil. And they have a little running bulletin board there with all the Navy news of the day. Here is the news item I found myself looking at on Tuesday. Headline: CNO honours Navy awardees at BEYA. That's the headline. Let me just unpack it a bit. CNO is Chief of Naval Operations, the highest ranking officer in the US Navy. He reports to the Secretary of the Navy, and he sits on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, along with General Casey and four or five other uniform suits. So, this top sailor was honouring Navy awardees at BEYA. What the heck is BEYA? No, I didn't know that one either. It's Black Engineer of the Year Awards. Let me quote for you from the Navy website bulletin. Quote, CNO Admiral Gary Roughhead presented two Navy civilians and a former Navy lieutenant with awards at the gala. Stephanie Easter and Sharon Smoot received the Professional Achievement in Government Award, and David Alexander received the Diversity Leadership Award. End quote. Once again, let me remind you, listeners, this is the top news item on the main information website for the United States Navy. You remember the United States Navy? Lake Champlain, Hampton Roads, Battle of Midway.
We joined the Navy to see the world. And what did we see? We saw the sea.
That's the one. Well, something funny happened to the US Navy when we weren't looking. It got taken over by elementary school principals. Don't believe me? Listen to Admiral Roughhead. Quote, holding events like the Black Engineer of the Year Awards is important because it allows us as a Navy, as a military, and as a nation to recognize the great contributions that men and women of diverse backgrounds make to our Navy, to our nation, to the military, and to so many different walks of life. We will be a better Navy because of diversity. Diversity is bringing together different perspectives, different experiences, different backgrounds, different opinions. And from that, we will be able to solve problems better. End quote. That's what the Admiral said. Recognizing contributions, celebrating diversity, different perspectives, different opinions, solving problems. None of that horrid old stuff about winning wars. No, sir, none of that. Of course, if we were to lose a war, that would be a tragedy. But it would be an even greater tragedy if our diversity became a casualty. Fortunately, with General Casey in charge of the Army and Admiral Roughhead looking after the Navy, there's no danger of that. I suppose I should check out the Air Force and the Marines, but I'm afraid of what I might find. Here's some music instead. Here's another update on a story from the past. This one we reported back in June of 08, a year and a half ago. This is the story of 48-year-old Tony Bologna of San Francisco and his two sons, Michael, aged 20, and Matthew, aged 16. All three were shot to death in the family car by Edwin Ramos, an illegal immigrant from El Salvador. Mr. Ramos was vexed when the Bologna's car blocked him from completing a left turn. Being vexed, and also being a career criminal and member of the psychotic MS-13 gang, Mr. Ramos vented his vexation by killing the three citizens, who were on their way home from a barbecue. Mr. Bologna's widow, Danielle, was left to mourn her husband and sons, and to support her two surviving children as best she could. But wait a minute, if Ramos was a career criminal and a gang member and also an illegal immigrant, why hadn't he been deported back to El Salvador long since? Why? Because this is San Francisco, that's why. San Francisco's a sanctuary city. That's sanctuary, as in sanctuary much, which is what illegal immigrants say after they've been booked for some crime, and then assured by the arresting officer that no matter what the outcome of the case, our country is their country. Nuestro país es su país. And there is no danger at all that they would be told to go home. So, Mr. Ramos was free to roam the streets of the city by the bay, slaughtering any car full of citizens who got in his way when he was making a left turn. Well, Mrs. Bologna thought it was shameful that the city had allowed Ramos to pursue his gang activities when they knew he was in this country illegally, which they did. She got a lawyer and sued the city. This week we got a ruling on that suit from Judge Charlotte Woolard of San Francisco Superior Court. Said Judge Woolard, quote, "Cities generally are not liable for failing to protect individuals against crime." That's actually not a bad point, Judge, although it would be a way better point if cities like San Francisco didn't prevent people from protecting themselves by severely restricting handgun possession. Good point or bad point, though, is it really the point at issue in this case? How about this one? Cities generally should show respect for federal laws and cooperate with federal authorities. Why was it up to poor, bereaved Mrs. Bologna to bring the suit anyway? Why isn't the Department of Justice suing the pants off these scofflaw cities? The immigration laws are the people's laws, passed by the people's representatives in Congress duly assembled. They have just the same jurisprudential status as, for example, the civil rights laws. Justice enforces them, doesn't it? If I gave the finger to a federal law, I'd have federal marshals breaking down my door before you could say Elian Gonzalez. So, why isn't justice all over the San Francisco Board of Supervisors like white on rice? Oh, right, I forgot. Because justice is staffed by people who hate the USA and think that the rights of foreigners take precedence over the rights of citizens. I forgot about that. Now, this is going to be hard for you listeners to believe, but Radio Derbs sometimes gets critical emails. Yes, there are listeners who take issue with my ex-cathedra pronouncements. Every so often, I shall expose a few so that you can hiss and boo at them. Here's a little crop from this week's email bag. Number one. Mr. Derbyshire, I was surprised at your take on the Alabama professor. I thought some commentators had made a very interesting observation that even though she was obsessed with Obama and was in fact a far-left nutcase, nobody in the MSM had mentioned it. Yet, even though the Austin IRS plane attack was perpetrated by a man who said he hated George W. Bush, he was given Tea Party status by the MSM. Did you not think that was interesting, or did you just think that card had been played enough already? Well, sir, here's one of the problems with writing for the public prints. You get so that you don't notice craziness, because your mail is full of it. I'm not referring to any of the listeners I may quote here, who are all sensible and percipient persons, as the great majority of our listeners, of course, are. There is a lunatic fringe out there, though, and they love to write emails. So, after a while, you just internalise the fact that some portion of the public is barking mad. Then, when someone from that demographic shows up in a news story, flying a plane into an IRS office, or shooting her colleagues at a faculty meeting, the crazy factor is muted, because you're so used to it. Similarly with the MSM twisting everything so that liberals look good and conservatives look bad. I have to read MSM stuff for a living. I just get inured to it. And while conceding my reader's point, why is it any surprise that the crazy Alabama professor was a liberal obsessed with Obama? Practically all college professors are liberals, and all liberals, I think without exception, are obsessed with Obama. Here's another complaint on a different topic, number two. Mr. Derbyshire, it's been ages since we heard any news of Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov, the charismatic president of Turkmenistan. Why aren't you keeping us up to date? Well, we have indeed been remiss in keeping listeners informed of the president's movements. So just a quick update here. Earlier this month, President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov was in Paris, though nobody seems to know why. He met with President Nicolas Sarkozy. The most specific accounts of the visit that I can find say that President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov was in France to, quote, foster bilateral ties. That's about as informative as when I ask my kids where they're going and they say, out. Back in Ashgabat, which I'm sure I don't need to tell you is the capital of Turkmenistan, President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov issued a decree, or a ukase, or an edict, a pronunciamento, or whatever the correct term is in Central Asia, declaring that he will permit a second political party to be formed to compete for votes with his own party, the Democratic Party of Turkmenistan. And that's all the news I have of President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov. Should my diligent staff of researchers pick up any further items on President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov, you can be sure that we shall bring them to your attention forthwith. Forthwith. Well, the internet's been a lot of fun, hasn't it? You probably logged in for the first time in the mid-1990s and have been surfing happily ever since, enjoying the wide variety of opinions and amusements, perhaps taking a quick peek now and then at some of the stuff out there on the fringes, maybe setting up your own website for fun or business. It's been great, a huge leap forward in technology for the ordinary citizen, making our lives more colourful and productive. Well, you can kiss goodbye to all that, pal. The forces of darkness have rallied, and they're all set to do everything they can to make the internet less citizen-friendly and more government-friendly. They fired an opening shot this week in Italy, where three executives of Google were convicted in a court trial of allowing an unsavoury video to be broadcast on the internet via Google Video. The actual charges they were convicted on were invasion of privacy, and they all got suspended 6-month sentences. The offending video showed an autistic teenager being bullied by his classmates at a school in Turin, Italy. The three Google employees had nothing to do with the video. So far as anyone can tell, the Italian authorities just picked them at random. It goes without saying they had nothing to do with the bullying. None of them even lives in Italy. Nobody knows what the Italian government has in mind here, but they seem determined to do what they can to harass other internet firms. And they have similar cases going against eBay, Yahoo, and Facebook. It is, of course, impossible for these firms to monitor everything that's uploaded. So, if their executives are to stay out of jail, they'll just have to shut down large segments of their businesses. Meanwhile, in Australia, Communications Minister Stephen Conroy is pushing a plan that will force internet service providers to filter material that is, quote, harmful. Who gets to decide what is harmful? Who do you think? Not you and me, that's for sure. Here's the punchline from a report in the Australian press, quote, the proposed scheme will place Australia with 15 other Western democratic nations that have or are preparing to implement ISP filters. End quote. 15 nations all gearing up to tell us what we may and may not view on the internet. Who's doing the technical work to set up these filters, though? Consultants on loan from the Chinese Communist Party would be my best guess. Here is Radio Derb's traditional miscellany of brief items to wrap up this week's broadcast. Item: Winter Olympics. The real action here, of course, is in curling, with results from the men's semi-finals being read out just as Radio Derb goes to tape. Canada beat Sweden by a healthy 6-3, and Norway prevailed over Switzerland 7-5. So it's Canada-Norway for the gold on Saturday, and Sweden-Switzerland for the bronze. In the women's semi-final this morning, Sweden trounced China, and Canada edged out Switzerland. So it's between Canada and Sweden for the gold on Friday, and you should root for Canada. If only because one of the team members on the curling team for Canada is named Carolyn Derbyshire. Other than curling, I don't think there's much of interest here, unless you're a girl or a girly man, in which case, of course, your focus will be on figure skating. Oh, darn it. I just set off one of the PC alarms. Item: the virtual wall of high-tech sensors and cameras and satellite feeds that our Department of Homeland Security has been erecting along the nation's southern border, in lieu of an actual, you know, like, wall, is not working very well and may never be completed. It was supposed to be completed next year, but, says the Los Angeles Times, it languishes in the testing phase in two remote spots of the border in Arizona. What a surprise. What a total surprise. How disappointing this must be to the government. Our Homeland Security Secretary, Janet Napolitano, is to order a department-wide assessment of the project. No doubt heads will roll. Oh yeah, I'm sure they will. Our politicians so desperately wanted this virtual wall to work. Republicans to stop the flow of cheap illegal labour to their campaign contributors, and Democrats to stanch the supply of new clients to the welfare state and future post-amnesty voters for the Democrat ward bosses. Yep, this must be a terrible disappointment all round in Washington. Item, just back to military matters for a moment. While here in the USA we are turning the Joint Chiefs into a coffee clatch of school moms, with soldiers only allowed to attend to their weapons and formations when they've satisfactorily completed their 80 hours a week of diversity training, in Turkey the military are still a force to be reckoned with. Traditionally they have been the guardians of Ataturk's legacy. that is, of a modern European-style secular government. The current ruling party in Turkey, by contrast, has a lot of Islamists in it, and that doesn't sit well with the military. The government has charged them with plotting a coup, and 40 senior army officers were arrested on Monday. Given the current state of Islam, most of us are going to side with the Turkish army on this one. I mean, another military coup in Turkey would be a tragedy, but it would be an even greater tragedy if Turkish diversity becomes a casualty here. Item, some rhubarb news here. The best rhubarb, as everyone knows, is grown in the rhubarb triangle of northeastern England. Well, this week the European Union granted protected designation of origin to the rhubarb from this region. So now, if you find yourself in England sitting down to a dish of rhubarb crumble with custard, listed on the restaurant menu as Yorkshire Forced Rhubarb, you can be sure it is the real thing. And if that's not a great advance for civilization, I don't know what is. Finally, what would Radio Derb be without a reminder to get a government job? If you've had an actual job in the actual economy, making things or buying and selling things, you've probably been fired at some point. It's happened to me a couple of times. And I've also been on the other side, firing people who weren't performing well, which is almost as stressful, although in a different way. It's all over pretty quickly, as I remember, since everyone involved is embarrassed and wants to get it over with. Well, that's how things go in the private sector. How about the public sector? Here's a story from Los Angeles. Quote, officials spent $3.5 million trying to fire just 7 of the district's 33,000 teachers for poor classroom performance, and only 4 were fired at last during legal struggles that wore on average, for 5 years each. 2 of the 3 others were paid large settlements, and 1 was reinstated. The average cost of each battle was $500,000, end quote. You see, in the private sector, it's 2 minutes with the boss, clean out your desk, down to payroll for the accrued, and out to the parking lot. In the public sector, it's 5 years of litigation, after which you either keep your job or take a 6-digit settlement. As Benjamin Disraeli said, two nations, two nations. That's about it, folks. Before signing off, though, just one more from the complaints box. This rather irate email comes from a listener on a Stairmaster somewhere in the Midwest. Mr. Derbyshire, most of the time I'm listening to Radio Derb while working out, with headphones on. Since I have open ear buds, I tend to have to crank the volume up to the maximum. When I was listening to the February 5th show, however, the bleeps in the Rahm Emanuel segment were loud, painfully so. For the benefit of those of us who'd still like to retain our hearing, by the time we're your age, my age, could you have Mandy, Candy and Brandy check the volume levels of spliced-in sound effects? Well, I'm afraid my well-buffed listener is nursing some confusion about the chain of command here at Buckley Towers. Mandy, Candy and Brandy are my research assistants, massaging the wire services to firm up suitable items to the standards required for insertion into a Radio Derb segment, or else they're down on their hands and knees in the file room rummaging about in drawers. Recording quality is the responsibility of Ahmed, my Pakistani assistant. Please understand that I have to deal very carefully with Ahmed, as he is the only Waziri Muslim here at Buckley Towers, and we don't want to lose him. If my Midwestern reader were to suffer permanent hearing loss as a result of Ahmed having misjudged the recording level, that would be a tragedy. But I believe it would be an even greater tragedy if our diversity becomes a casualty here.